Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session. Pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Justice Hightower is out this morning, but he will take part in the deliberation and decision of these causes. This morning we have only two matters left on the oral submission docket. In the order in which they are presented, they are as follows. Dow Chemical Company versus the Honorable Ricardo H. Garcia, an original mandamus proceeding, which will be consolidated for oral argument with Dow Chemical Company versus the Honorable Gary Sanderson, also an original mandamus proceeding, and Roy Wayne Farrow and others versus Chambers County from Chambers County. In each of these causes, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Relator or petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk. If you desire to purchase a tape of either argument, you may make application with our clerk. We welcome this morning our newest justice, Justice James Baker, who is sitting publicly with the court for the first time. Court is now ready to hear argument from Relator in Dow Chemical versus Garcia and Sanderson.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Josephson will present an argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I guess the first question that I would bring to the court's attention is the question of whether this matter is, at this point in time, ripe for argument or whether it should continue to be abated. As the court is aware...
Well, there is another option, which is to dismiss it altogether.
I understand that. And I will address that, Your Honor.
And you'll address the latest brief respondent to this.
Yes. We, for the court's information, have filed a brief this morning dealing with a direct response to the motion to dismiss. Let me see if I can start this way. At this point in time, I do not believe that the court can dismiss this mandamus. We believe that under your decision in Meyerland and the removal statute itself, Section 1446, that once these matters were removed, that this must continue to be abated as opposed to dismissed.
Could we remove the stay?
Pardon?
Do we have the authority to remove the stay?
We do not believe that you do, Your Honor. We believe that this is no different than once you accepted and it gave us leave to file a petition for writ of mandamus under the government code. We believe that this occupies the same status as an appeal, thereby making your decisions in Meyerland applicable to this type of action. The mere fact that it's labeled a mandamus proceeding, an original proceeding in mandamus, versus an appeal from a decision of a trial court or an appellate court, we believe compels no different result than if it were an ordinary appeal, and therefore that the matter should continue to be abated. Having said that, what I would like to do is explain why we believe if the case comes back, it is not mooted by the fact that Dow Corning Corporation's, the case against Dow Corning Corporation in these mandamus proceedings brought by the Comos and the Peñas, the fact that they reside in another court does not moot the proceedings against Dow Chemical in this court. And let me see if I can explain that. First, we've handed the court some exhibits, which I'll refer to. The fact of the matter in these cases, in just a simple factual summary, Dow Corning is the manufacturer of silicone breast implants. They are the manufacturer, they are the designer, they are the seller of silicone breast implants. That fact is not disputed. Dow Chemical Company is a 50% owner of the Dow Corning Corporation, along with another company called Corning Inc., a company located in New York. Both Dow Chemical Company, Corning Inc., and a number of physicians were sued in these cases along with Dow Corning Corporation. In this particular case, the plaintiffs sought to sever out Dow Corning Corporation from Dow Chemical because of the filing of Dow Corning of a bankruptcy proceeding. In the Sanderson action, what the plaintiffs actually did was not only to sever out Dow Corning Corporation, but to also sever out Corning Corporation and all of the physicians and leave Dow Chemical in a separate case. Thereby, we contend, if this matter were to come back tomorrow, to be remanded tomorrow, what this court would be faced with is a clear violation of its dictates in guaranteed federal trust, guaranteed savings, in that interwoven claims between and cross actions between Dow Chemical on one hand and Corning Inc. on the other are now in separate proceedings.
But we could never grant the relief you asked for, and that is to rejoin the cases, can we? Because Dow Corning is in federal court.
Except that now Corning Inc. and the physicians are in another cause of action from that of Dow Chemical Company. They would be coming back. They would be in a different cause of action.
And that has not been your argument to date, has it? Being that the doctors are in a separate action? I mean, has that been your argument?
Well, we attacked the order. The order was filed. The order was not, if I can go back with a little history, when this was argued, the plaintiffs indicated they were going to sever out Dow Corning, not everyone else in the case. What in fact happened when they submitted their order, which we did not see, was in fact to sever out everyone, including defendants not in bankruptcy, with the exception of the Dow Chemical Company, Dow Chemical Company alone, even though we contend the claims are interwoven.
My question was, has that been your argument in this court today, that because the doctors have been severed out from Dow Chemical, but that was abuse of discretion? Has that been your argument yet?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
We raised that argument in response to the motion to dismiss. We have not filed an additional response because of the abatement entered by this court. When the plaintiffs filed the motion to dismiss last week, claiming that there was no matter that could conceivably be ripe for decision and that everything was moot, we brought forth to this court's attention the arguments that we would raise had this matter come back and we were permitted to have oral argument. At the time we filed the petition for writ of mandamus, there was no the cause against Dow Corning had not been removed. It was in fact still in state court in another cause of action, and that was our primary complaint, but we attacked the entire order of severance.
If we were to grant your relief, where in your view would these cases get tried? Where would the plaintiff's cases be tried if the bankruptcy court refused to assume jurisdiction? Where would they be tried?
Let's assume this scenario. Let's assume that Dow Chemical, the case against Dow Chemical is in Beaumont, and let's assume that the case against Dow Corning brought by the Comos is in a federal court in Michigan. Let's assume that scenario. If the first thing the court would need to do would be to rejoin the non-bankrupt defendants
in the
Sanderson case.
Which court?
This court, if the trial court would not agree to bring the two causes of action back together again, to bring Corning and the physicians into our case, we would ask this court to take that action pursuant to the guaranteed savings case.
You have no objection to, if there was some way to rejoin Corning Corporation and the physicians with the lawsuit against Dow Chemical, that would accord you all the relief you're asking?
No, that's only step one. Step two is as follows. The plaintiffs acknowledge that with Dow Corning in another lawsuit, they state in their brief that they can only pursue causes of action against Dow Chemical Company, for which Dow Chemical Company has independent liability. In other words, they can't pursue causes of action against Dow Chemical Company, for which a predicate finding is the liability of Dow Corning Corporation. We have given the court several examples of that. The plaintiffs continue, although the plaintiffs agree with the proposition that I am stating to the court now, that is, that they can't pursue an alter ego claim against Dow Chemical, because an alter ego claim belongs to the bankrupt estate. They can't pursue claims against Dow Chemical, which would involve predicate findings against Dow Corning, because Dow Corning isn't there. They concede the basic premise under the third prong of guarantee savings that to proceed against Dow Chemical, they can only do so on causes of action that are independent. In other words, where Dow Chemical did something wrong independently and apart from something Dow Corning did. But yet, in their pleadings, having said this in their briefs, in their pleadings, they continue to assert, in the Pena case, an alter ego claim against Dow Chemical, a conspiracy, concert of action, and aiding and abetting claims, which are all predicated on liability findings against Dow Corning, a party which isn't there, and
Counsel,
a party...
Can I ask you a question?
Certainly.
In the response in the Sanderson case, the respondent asserts that all of the derivative claims against Dow have been disposed of by summary judgment since the May 15th severance order. Is that correct?
In the Sanderson case... Yes. The alter ego claims and corporate veil claims have been eliminated by summary judgment. Not so in the Pena case, which is before the court.
My question was broader than that. What about the conspiracy and the action?
They're still there in all of the cases. In all of the cases, they haven't been dismissed, and the plaintiffs concede that liability claims predicated upon a finding against Dow Corning, that they're not seeking liability against Dow Chemical for such causes of action.
If we dispose, if we say the court, I guess I'm a little bit confused about the posture in your argument. The issue here is, was an abuse of discretion to sever Dow Chemical from Dow Corning. You're arguing now that it was an abuse for, as I understand your argument, you're arguing that it's an abuse for the trial judge to have severed all of the claims against Dow Chemical. What the trial judge should have done is only severed the claims of Dow Chemical that were independent sources of liability, and not, is that your argument?
The judge messed up by
not dividing up the various plaintiffs' claims and severing some and not severing others?
The original argument was that under the prong three of the guaranteed savings case, if the claims between Dow Chemical and Dow Corning were so interwoven so that they involve the same issues of fact, a severance would have been improper. The plaintiffs have argued in response to that, but these are different issues. We're not seeking liability against Dow Chemical for those claims that are, for claims that are interwoven. Our claims against Dow Chemical only seek relief where Dow Chemical is independently responsible and do not require a predicate finding against Dow Corning. That was their argument to the judge as to why the third prong of the guarantee savings clause that case was met.
And it's your position that all of the claims that the plaintiffs brought against Dow Chemical are derivative of liability against Dow Chemical?
That is our contention. But if the court fashioned relief and stated and directed the trial courts to only try those cases in which a predicate finding against Dow Corning was not required or where there was an independent basis for liability against Dow Chemical, I'm not suggesting that this court would need to individually go through each cause of action and make such a determination, but I am suggesting that because we have literally thousands of these cases pending in the state, that some guidance be given to the trial courts, which firmly explains to them that that cases involving conspiracy, concert of action, aiding and abetting, or theories such as those which involve a predicate finding of liability against Dow Corning by the very nature of the cause of action, as opposed to an independent determination against Dow Chemical, should not be tried against Dow Chemical. Rather, before that predicate finding you can even argue that can be made. The plaintiffs must dispose of their claims against against Dow Corning. They still have those claims against Dow Corning. There is still a lawsuit entitled Como versus Dow Corning in an appellate court, or rather in a federal court. It is still there. It is not a theoretical case. It exists. They are making claims in that case. And so that, and those claims are distinct and apart from those of Dow Chemical. Finally, the other problem, Your Honors, and a, we believe a serious impediment to proceeding against us, is the contribution statute, Chapter 33.
Well, and, counsel, if we gave you the relief you just asked for, that's not an issue.
Well,
it is to only try the cases where you're directly liable. You can't get contribution from Dow Corning on those, can you?
Well, if, except for the statute reads that any tortfeasor who's responsible for the plaintiff's injury, but their conduct is, if they manufactured a defective product and we were liable under a negligence theory, let's say we negligently tested the product, but Dow Corning manufactured a defective product, you would have the jury compare the conduct of both parties against the plaintiffs if there was any contributory negligence, there would be a percentage result. And in a, we would be entitled to a reduction in that verdict based on the amount or percentage of liability against Dow Corning. What I'm suggesting is that the statute gives us, gives at our option, at the option of the defendant, the right to seek a contribution claim, which we have done. And I'm saying that the statute does not make an exception for the bankruptcy of a defendant. In other words, the statute nowhere says that you can't seek that right of contribution from Dow Corning if Dow Corning is in bankruptcy. In the 1995 Act, enacted by the legislature in September of 19, in effective September 1, 1995, which we cite in our brief, the legislature, in fact, did make an exception for bankruptcy. So it wasn't that the legislature didn't know how to do it. In the new provisions, which allow a third party to bring in a defendant, they define the defendant who can be brought in by a third party as a defendant not in bankruptcy or a defendant not insolvent. So they have specifically said in the new Chapter 33, there is a class of defendants, and if you want to implead them in the case, you can't do it if they're in bankruptcy. And what I'm saying here,
prior to 1995, if you can make a colorable claim that a potential tortfeasor is in bankruptcy, then that stops the whole trial.
It stops the trial until the claim against that tortfeasor is resolved. For instance, let's assume that there was
hardly any mature mass tort could ever go to trial.
Not necessarily.
Until all the federal bankruptcy claims.
I'm suggesting that the legislature made no exception for that, and that I sought to find such an exception in that statute and did not find it in the statute prior to September 1, 1995. And I'm suggesting that the legislature, in fact, did engraft that exception to apply in cases which accrue after September 1st, 1995, regarding the third-party practice of bringing in other defendants who might be insolvent.
So my question is, what are you saying is the logical conclusion of that on the state of the statute as we have?
Well, I mean, I can give the court an example. Suppose that the Como's claim was settled. Then they would become, and it's settled in bankruptcy. It doesn't matter where it's settled or resolved. They could become a settling tortfeasor. And if they become a settling tortfeasor, or a settling party rather, if they become a settling party, then of course there are different rules under the contribution statute regarding
until that happens, you would say this court should pronounce that cases can, across the board cases cannot go to trial if a potential tortfeasor from whom contribution could be obtained is in the midst of a live bankruptcy proceeding.
I am saying that under the way the statute is currently written, I don't see an exception.
And that's what this court, that's how this court should read the statute.
Unless the court engrafts an exception that the legislature did not engraft on that statute, I do not see an exception, Your Honor. And that's I think my time is.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Luke Soltz will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. Dow Chemical is asking this court to command Judge Sanderson and Judge Garcia to do something that is not and will never be within their jurisdiction to do. That is to reunite breast implant claims against Dow Corning with breast implant claims against Dow Chemical. Dow Corning is forever lodged in the bankruptcy system. Dow Chemical...
Chapter 11?
Pardon?
Aren't they in the Chapter 11?
Well, as far as the resolution of these claims, Judge Baker, they are lodged in bankruptcy.
You used the word forever, isn't that a little...
As far as these claims are concerned, yes, I agree. But as far as these claims are concerned, Dow Corning is forever lodged in the federal system. It will not be back to state court.
Now
there have been circumstances where state courts have proceeded to try cases and liquidate claims that are in the bankruptcy process. That will not happen here because Dow Corning did two things, not just one. It filed bankruptcy. That alone does not preclude a state court from going forward if there is a lift of the automatic stay permitting the state court to go forward. But Dow Corning did a second thing. They moved to have the bankruptcy judge transfer all claims against Dow Corning to the bankruptcy court. And that was granted. So all the claims, wherever they were situated, in state court or federal courts, were taken within the jurisdiction of Judge Spector and the referring court, Federal District Court, Judge Hood. Thereupon, 28 U.S.C. Section 157b5 gives Judge Hood the authority to do two things with those cases. Try them in the district where the bankruptcy is pending, or send them to a federal district in which the claims arose. And that's it. They will not come back to state court, the claims against Dow Corning. Likewise, the contribution claims will not come back. And the idea that the state statute permits Dow Chemical to state trials because it cannot get a bankrupt party in as a third-party defendant or cross-action in order to assist with its contribution is completely dispelled by the federal law, which obviously, under the Supremacy Clause of the federal Constitution, trumps anything that the Texas legislature might choose to do. Our brief at page 16 cites the relevant portion of Lynch, a Sixth Circuit decision, and that's where the bankruptcy is pending in the Sixth Circuit. And it talks about this very problem of cases being tried against non-debtors and the non-debtor is not being able to get contribution from the debtor. And it says, as such, well, it says the bankruptcy forum is the forum for indemnity and contribution. Cites 11 U.S.C. 362. And it says, as such, duplication of trials, to the extent it may exist, is congressionally created and sanctioned. Obviously, the Congress has spoken to this issue, and that would be the governing law. Neither Judge Sanderson nor Judge Garcia today has jurisdiction over either party. Judge Hood has said that the local federal district judges should remand these cases back to state court. That may or may not be done, because I'm assuming that the local federal district judges have their own say about that, but it probably will be done. So for purposes of our discussion today, if we're going to get that far, we can assume that these cases now before you, the underlying cases, may get back to state court. Then what? They still cannot be reunited with the Dow Corning, claims against Dow Corning, and they cannot be reunited with the contribution claims. Why? Because of Chapter 11 U.S.C., the bankruptcy statute. If this court does not proceed, does not permit Judge Sanderson and Judge Garcia to go to trial or to provide trials for the plaintiffs, breast implant plaintiffs against Dow Chemical, there will be two constitutional violations. One, a violation of the Texas Open Courts constitutional provision. That's not just limited to the LaCroix situation where the legislature takes some action that may be violative. That provision governs every individual who administers the system of justice in the state of Texas. And the second is the 14th Amendment of the Federal Constitution, which says that states will not deny due process, will not take property without due process, and will not limit property rights without due process. Of course, a personal injury claim is an established property right.
Mr. Soles, Mr. Josephson argued that under the Maryland case and the removal statute, we don't have jurisdiction to remove the state. What's your response?
I say there, I think very clearly you do. Maryland has to do with going forward with an appeal in the face of a special federal statute that allowed the FDIC to remove a case to federal court wherever it might be at the time in the state court system. So that case got removed. It was, of course, an appeal. It was not an original proceeding. A fundamental difference in our case is this is an original proceeding. Also, it's an original proceeding brought only by a non-debtor, Dow Chemical, who the bankruptcy judges have said, and Judge Hood and Judge Becker have said, they have no jurisdiction over Dow Chemical. There is nothing about an automatic stay or even the limited extension that's been made of the automatic stay that even speaks to anything about this case.
Do you agree that there's nothing we can do until the Sixth Circuit finally disposes of the matter on appeal?
Absolutely not. Because I think, you know, it doesn't make a bit of difference what the Sixth Circuit does on that, in that appeal. The taking of jurisdiction, I mentioned earlier, by Judge Hood, of all claims against Dow Corning, is not even being reviewed. No one complains about that. So the Sixth Circuit's not even going to address that issue. That's resolved. The only thing that's being reviewed is, does Judge Hood have jurisdiction over Dow Chemical? There's another piece to that, too. If they say Judge Hood does have jurisdiction over Dow Chemical, Judge Hood has the right to abstain. So I guess that'll go back up. If it comes back, she says, well, now that they've told me I have jurisdiction, I'll abstain. But it doesn't make a bit of difference in this court's judgment in this case, because Judge Sanderson and Judge Garcia had authority under Gatex Aircraft, Lynch, which I've just spoken about out of the Sixth Circuit, Gatex out of the Fifth Circuit, and Wedgeworth out of the Fifth Circuit, to do these severances, or to go ahead and go to trial against Dow Chemical without a severance. They didn't even have to sever. The smart thing, I think, is to do so. So the message gets to the bankruptcy court, we are not proceeding against Dow Corning. We've started a trial, but they're out, Dow Chemical's in. But Lynch, out of the Sixth Circuit, and Gatex Aircraft out of the Fifth Circuit says, Our trial judges don't even have to do that. They can just start the trial, get the parties in, the recording's gone, and start the trial with all the other, with the other parties present. So there is no way that this court's order, if it did sign an order commanding Judge Garcia and Judge Sanderson to vacate their services, for the reason I've just told you, probably doesn't make any difference because they can proceed without the order. Secondly, it just doesn't seem right to me, and I feel it has to be shared, that a trial judge would be commanded to vacate an order which, if he does that, it could be interpreted as a confrontation with the bankruptcy court. It would be in contravention of the bankruptcy judge's order that they take Dow Corning and not take Dow Chemical. Could it be an interference? Probably not actually an interference, but it's a useless act. It's a void. It will not accomplish anything if they are ordered, if those two judges are ordered to vacate their severance orders.
Mr. Soule, how about the argument that to allow the cases to proceed in the state court without Dow Corning being present so distorts the trial that it's a tremendous denial of substantive rights to Dow Chemical?
Well, I think the most direct answer that I have to that, Justice Gonzalez, is what was said in Lynch, that the duplication, to the extent it may exist, is congressionally created and sanctioned. Now, this court sided with approval of a Waco court case, Weaver versus Jock, that sided with approval, and this is directly responsive to your question, I think, sided with approval in Guarantee Horseshoe, where a subcontractor sued the general and the owner, and the general went into bankruptcy, and the trial court severed and permitted the sub to go forward against the general. Almost exactly these same facts. And this court cited, in Guarantee versus Horseshoe, cited that case with approval.
Was there a predicate finding of liability in that case necessary in order to get through the contract?
Well, of course, the subcontractor contracted with the general contractor. So there had to be, that relationship had to be established in order for the subcontractor to have a claim against the owner for to be paid. But there will always be some related, perhaps highly integrated facts where you have joint tort feasors or joint defendants even arising out of a contractual situation, that there will be overlapping facts. But that's the federal bankruptcy law is what's created this problem. And now we have to deal with it. Excuse me.
Is there any other rule in our rule of civil procedure dealing with this problem other than 39B that talks about necessary parties and the joinder of parties? Is there any? 39B addresses the issue where it just is such a bad circumstance, plaintiff's claim should be dismissed if they can't get all the defendants before the court. So the rule of civil procedure deal with the problem where, as Dow Chemical raises, that we just can't do this without Dow Corning being a part of this lawsuit. So 39B addresses that. But that says it's just so bad that plaintiff's claims just ought to be dismissed. And I don't see Dow Chemical calling for that to occur. Are there any other rules that deal with this problem of where one party says, I've just got to have this other party in the lawsuit, and if they're not here, the court needs to either abate the case or put it on hold for indefinitely, or is there anything else that deals with this problem?
The only other rule that comes to mind, I think it's the only one, that deals with severance is Rule 41. And it doesn't, of course, lay out any very strong criteria. I really don't think that the rule, that any rule lays out very objective criteria for us to be guided by in severance. But if we go back into the case law, these cases that are stopped because all the parties can't be gotten together are cases where there were traditionally, traditional term for that was indispensable parties. For example, I sue to cancel a deed and I don't get all the grantees served. I can't go forward to cancel the deed until I manage to get all the grantees in. That very, very narrow circumstances, which at one time this court held were constituted fundamental error to go forward. Other than that, it's a discretionary matter with the trial judge to be reviewed for abuse of discretion. And of course, joint tortfeasors, there's never been a rule that the plaintiff had to sue joint tortfeasors or that all the joint tortfeasors had to be in court. And even today, in 1995 tort reform, there's a category of people called responsible third parties. They're clearly joint tortfeasors, as is defined, but they're not in the case. Their negligence can be submitted in comparative responsibility, but even that can't happen if they're in bankruptcy. I mean, there's the policy is, to me, almost ancient and then brought current by the very 1995 legislature that joint tortfeasors are not required to be sued, are not even required to be in the case. And contribution and indemnity claims have always been claims that could be brought separately and after the case. Defendants wanted this, they didn't want to be suing, might not want to be suing each other in front of the plaintiff's case. No such thing as a compulsory cross-action in our rules. Counterclaims, yes. Cross-actions, no. The only case on compulsory cross-actions is whenever one defendant sued the other, they said, well, if you want to sue him back, you sue him back. But there's no requirement to initiate a cross-action. That can all be done later. And in the context of bankruptcy, if there's duplication, it's congressionally created and sanctioned. Womack versus Berry is a very good case, I think, to raise to both of the last questioners. And Womack versus Berry, it was a mistake case. One of the parties had a Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act issue come up and was put out of the process. The trial judge stopped the case, wouldn't let it go forward, because one party had Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act protection. And this court issued a writ of mandamus to the trial judge saying that that party had to be severed and that the case was to go forward to trial. Dow Chemical's latest brief does not join issue with ours on the mootness. It raises other issues, but it does not join issue with us on the mootness. So, in closing, Dow Chemical has sought the relief that it now asks from you, from Judge Becker, denied. From Judge Hood, denied. They tried to merge their claims with Dow Corning's there. And the federal judges say, we're going to keep Dow Corning, but we're not going to take Dow Chemical. I believe that that federal bankruptcy process has worked through its course. And we know that Dow Corning will be staying there. And that that bankruptcy process, having worked through its course, is persuasive, if not perhaps binding us under the Supremacy Clause in this court. Judge Hood has said in her order, I know you'll read it if you haven't, that the underlying cases against Dow Chemical are to go forward. And there's no distinction between state and federal. As a matter of fact, Judge Hood says, the underlying cases are to go forward and the federal district judges should remand them back to state court if the only jurisdictional allegation is related to, which is the case. So, under the Supremacy Clause, under our own Constitution, and under the federal Constitution, these ladies should have their day in court, in a Texas court, and I do not believe that this court will consider closing the Texas courthouse to these plaintiffs until some distant future day when Dow Chemical decides to take Dow Corning out of bankruptcy by making a resolution.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I wanted to address a few distinct issues. First of all, let me talk about the abatement issue. I have again read the Meyerland case that we've all cited. The Meyerland case nowhere says we're doing this because of the special federal statute for RIA. It simply says when this case was removed to federal court and there was an appeal pending, we lost our authority to take any further action except to abate. That's all we ask this court to do. We ask this court to continue to abate to see if these cases against Dow Chemical come back to state court. We are not asking this court to make some decree that will bring Dow Corning back into this lawsuit. We are asking this court to take actions which will protect Dow Chemical if these cases come back.
If which cases come back?
If the case against Dow Chemical that is now in federal court comes back, the case against Corning Inc. that is now in federal court comes back, the case against the physicians, which is now in federal court, all come back.
But not Dow Corning. If all that's remanded at the state court, but not with Dow Corning, you would agree that we should then lift abatement and allow the state courts to proceed?
I'm saying that we are asking you to take action consistent with Texas law and procedure to determine whether those cases, if they come back, can proceed. That's what the purpose of my argument is today.
Let me ask you about your contribution in indemnity claims against Dow Corning. Those are in the bankruptcy court, is that correct? And they will be adjudicated one way or the other in the bankruptcy court.
That would be true, except that they could be adjudicated in some other in another form.
But in a federal
they could be adjudicated in a federal court assigned out by the Article III judge.
You're a contingent claimant.
Pardon?
You're a contingent non-secured debtor in bankruptcy.
Well, we're a shareholder. We have other rights.
But as far as the contribution indemnity claims,
you're an
unsecured contingent claimant.
Correct.
And you will be treated under the plan in some fashion in the bankruptcy.
Presumably.
So the state court will never, under any circumstances, get back your contribution and indemnity claims as to these cases.
That is true factually, but that our argument, of course, is that the contribution statute of this state says we have a right to have that defendant's conduct adjudicated for purposes of our rights of contribution.
But that's been superseded by the bankruptcy action, has it not? You will not be able to proceed in state court on your contribution and indemnity claims they collect against Dow Corning.
Not necessarily, and I wanted to call the court's attention to the Wedgeworth case, which has been cited by everyone. It's a Fifth Circuit case, and it's in our brief and it's in their brief. That case involved a situation where the Johns Manville bankruptcy occurred, and other manufacturers sought protection and stays and abatements because Johns Manville, another manufacturer, was in bankruptcy. The Fifth Circuit in that particular case said, since you other defendants were manufacturers like Johns Manville, we understand you have a claim for contribution. But because you're all manufacturers, the claims against you can proceed. And we're not going, and they take precedence over your contribution rights. But the Fifth Circuit very specifically said there could come a time when other fact situations occur when this would not be so, and when the rights of the defendant to its contribution claim so outweigh the rights of the plaintiffs to proceed because of the nature or factual circumstances, that we might reach a different result in that scenario.
But where would the contribution claim be tried? Even under that scenario?
In that case, the question would be, could you proceed, could you go forward against Dow Chemical at all because of the fact that they would not have a right of contribution? That was what the defendants were arguing in that case. They were saying, we're entitled to a stay.
Is it your position that because Dow Chemical cannot get contribution against Dow Corning, your plaintiff's claim should be dismissed?
No. Because that's
the result of your statement saying that the right to contribution could be so important to Dow Chemical that the plan shouldn't be allowed to proceed. Aren't you saying that under Rule 39 at B, that Dow Corning is so important to Dow Chemical in this case that the plaintiff's claims against Dow Chemical should be dismissed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because of the fact that there is a means under our Texas contribution statute, if Dow Corning reaches a resolution with the plaintiffs, that they become a settling, under Texas contribution law, they become a settling person. If they become a settling person, then you have a different scenario about rights and contribution, because it doesn't really matter where Dow Corning is once they settle the claims with the plaintiffs, and those plaintiffs have claims against Dow Corning. And if the bankruptcy is settled, or if those cases are resolved...
You're just saying you get a credit against the plaintiffs if they settle with Dow Corning.
I get more than just a credit, because we have the joint and several liability issue here. If my conduct is under 11%, then I am not jointly and severally liable for Dow Corning's conduct in these cases. That's a very important right to me. In a case involving $1 million, if Dow Corning's conduct is adjudicated in that proceeding and a jury finds them 90% and Dow Chemical 10%, I owe $100,000 and not $1 million. And that, to me, that's a very significant right. And I think what I was saying was that Wedgeworth says, were you not just another manufacturer like Dow Corning, like Johns Manville in that context, we might reach a different result because your right would need to be protected also. And it's a balancing test. But I'm saying here, we are not another manufacturer of breast implants. We were a company that never made, designed, or sold
breast implants. Well, I mean, I understand that's your argument, but in response to the Chief's question to you, you are asking for a rule that says if there is a joint tortfeasor who files for bankruptcy, then the state claims must be stayed until a final resolution of the bankruptcy against the joint tortfeasor. That's the rule that you argue.
If you believe that they sued us for an independent action that did not involve a right of contribution, hypothetical, let's assume Dow Chemical is sued for an independent cause of action that did not involve a right of contribution against Dow Corning. Well, then no. Then my argument wouldn't be that the suit should be abated until the contribution claim was resolved, because in my hypothetical, there would be no contribution claim. So if you have a hypothetical claim against us that we did something that did not involve the actions of Dow Corning, so we couldn't get contribution from Dow Corning, then, of course, the contribution statute wouldn't apply, and we wouldn't have a right to contribution under those circumstances.
Would you then agree if all of the derivative actions are no longer in the suit that your argument then would lead us to a conclusion that the case should go forward?
The problem, I can't agree to that, and that's why I said hypothetically, because Dow Corning is still the manufacturer of the product. And under Texas contribution law, you submit the conduct of all the potential tortfeasors to the jury. They apportion liability under that scenario. So while they may not have participated in my specific action, they were still the manufacturer of the product. Now, if they were a settling tortfeasor, you could solve the problem that you were talking about, and then the case could proceed. If you had only liability claims that were independent against Dow Chemical and Dow Corning was a settling tortfeasor, then that might come very close to solving the problem, allow the case to proceed. But until that happens, my contention is that under Texas law, and under the fact situation before the court, that the cases cannot proceed and that this issue will face the court when these cases come back, and because of the vast number of these cases, that the court should ride on this issue because of the fact that we should not try numerous cases only to be back here again to try to formulate a rule.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first set of consolidated causes, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Please rise.